lesson number 12. The official title here is Heroism, Hypocrisy, Deception, and Misunderstanding, the Suez Crisis and the Sinai Campaign of 56, Part 2. The left off in the middle of, you know, last week's episode of The Perils of Holding the Israel and France and Britain, for reasons that we went into last time, had colluded, as the expression goes, had organized themselves into a secret alliance with an unorthodox sort of a plan of attack. The plan that they worked out was to make Britain and France look innocent, and therefore Israel was supposed to invade the Sinai Peninsula, take it over in October, certain date of 56. At a certain point, after they did that, England and France and the rest of the world would express suitable horror, whereupon, this is the plan, the British and the French would then say, the things that need to be done to ensure international peace and to secure the security of the Suez Canal as a waterway for international shipping is for the British and the French army to come in and physically separate the Israeli army on the one side and the Egyptian on the other side, to do it in the Shema, in the name of world peace. And meanwhile, it's just going to happen that the British would retake the canal as a result of that. The plan was that Egypt, in case they make any trouble, and the plan is they weren't making trouble, they will invade Egypt, knock out Nasser, put in a different government, and everybody be happy. That was the plan. They didn't tell Eisenhower about this, we saw, when Eisenhower was in the middle of a presidential election, but everybody thought precisely because it's the middle of a presidential election, they'll be able to get away, because we all know that American politicians, whenever they come to Israel during the election season, everybody goes kissed up the Israeli lobby. So the specific plan was, there was one cooked up by Moshe Dayan, which was very unorthodox, wanted to make it look like a raid rather than an invasion, although it eventually turned into an invasion. And the idea was to fly parachutists, no, to drop parachutists out of nowhere. In other words, there's no war going on, and all of a sudden, Israeli planes would fly into the Sinai Desert, which is very long and thick, I'm sure you know. Israel, the old Israel is 8,000 miles square, and the Sinai Peninsula is 24,000 miles square, so it's three times the size of Israel. And most of the Sinai Desert, and I know I'm looking at this crowd, I know people have actually been there from the old days when Israel still had it, it's uninhabited, it's rocky, it's mountainous, it's all this, you know, it's not very hospitable. And therefore, it's not like Israel is going into a territory with a lot of people. The population of the whole continent at that time was 40,000 Bedouins. And besides that's basically what it was there. And the idea was to fly to the other side of the Sinai Peninsula, not the side of Israel, but the other end, land right from the middle of hand, which is two mountain passes which you need to get through in order to traverse the Sinai. Then once they're there, they couldn't do like in some movie. I mean, you know, in the movies, you land in you parachute in a pass. Realize that the death for parachutists. I hope you understand that. You don't land people in mountains. some countries have tried to do that. It's called the Polish Army. You land them in front of the mountains, and then they come in and take over. So once Israel landed over there, no one would know. Just one of these fancy schmancy Israeli counter raids. After all, the Egyptians raid Israel. It's a raid thesis, as we described with Italy, what's going on during these years. This just looks like a bigger version of a raid, and be plausible deniability if anything goes wrong. And then, once they land over there, then an Israeli armor column under Ariel Sharon is supposed to go help them for 11, discharge from Israel, from the Negev, all the way across the Sinai Peninsula to catch up with them as soon as possible. And then the joint force theater will storm and capture the Mitla pass, and then that will choke off the Egyptian forces that are in the Sinai, and then the Israelis, as you see in a minute, will launch several pronged campaigns, a column up here, a column here, and a column there, to try to take over whatever military positions are necessary to take over in order to conquer the Sinai Peninsula. What I'm trying to say is you can't physically, the country size of Israel can't physically occupy every inch, nor is there any reason to, of the Sinai Desert, because there's nothing there. Only that the Egyptian army has certain bases over there, and certain strong points, and places like that, and that's what you want to take over. And if you do that, then you've got the whole business. Recall that part of the plan was that Israel's not going to take over all of the Sinai Peninsula, but rather they're going to go up to 10 miles. So the British and the French are going to say, the two sides should all stay away. Israel should stay 10 miles away from the Suez Canal on this side. The Egyptian army under Nasser should stay away 10 miles there, and the British and French should land in the middle. So from the very beginning, Moshe Dayan knows, in real reality, we're supposed to take over all of Sinai up to 10 miles before the Suez Canal. Okay, if you followed that, then great. Now, as I said before, it looks like a raid. The problem is that, as always happens with the fog of war, the bad information about the Egyptian positions in the middle of Paris, when they came there, they thought there were no soldiers there, and they found out there were, and then they found out there are a lot of Egyptian soldiers over there, and Ariel Sharon ordered a frontal assault, which resulted in heavy casualties for the Israelis, leading to controversy and recrimination. I know that Sharon at this minute is dying. I know you read it in the paper like I read, you know, the vegetable thing is falling apart, whatever they call it. And so therefore, what do the Romans say? The mortuus non nosi bonum, since they speak there about the dead, but he was very, the rest of his life, I mean, till today, their family's very angry at Sharon because they think he incorrectly ordered a frontal assault on the Egyptian positions when he came there, when it wasn't necessary to do so. They could have done other ways. Most of anything here, he's telling you, you know, in war, the only thing that matters is winning. And so he captured it, and so I'm not going to do a court-martial or anything like that. He was successful in obtaining his mission. Okay? And to be perfectly honest, this is Israel, so you'll understand this very well, especially in an audience like ours. He lost 37 men killed. Now, I'm not saying that's a small number, because every person is a lot. But you understand it's not a large number of casualties either. And so it's all a matter of relative. In the total signing campaign, Israel is 230 men. If you should get an idea what I'm talking about. The total war is 230 men. Which is, if you want to get an idea, they were losing something like that from the Fedayeen raid, from the terrorist raid, roughly that number. Anyway, so these are how the numbers work. Elsewhere, once that happens, so then, you know, the Israel is basically without declaring it as a war, meaning they're sending their soldiers into the Sinai, and they go through several columns, as I said before, and they easily outflank and defeat the Egyptians in a four-day campaign. That's what it was. It was a four-day business. And which ends the campaign that was October 29th, the 30th, 31st, and November 1st. November 1st, 4 days before the American election. Okay? So right when all this is happening is right when Eisenhower and Stevenson are going head-to-head in the famous 56th election, and this really muddies up the American political scene because, you know, what is it, not going to be part of the election campaign? Don't you think Adlai Stevenson, as eloquent as he was, is not going to say, look at the violence that's emerging in the Middle East, this is a sign of the bankruptcy of the Eisenhower administration policy, and if those don't even know what's going on, you don't want a guy who's playing golf and doesn't follow what's happening in the world there, put me in and all the rest of it, and Eisenhower's just steaming and all that. Now the funny thing is, let's take a look at the next map. You can see over here, a little hard for me to see, but the Israeli forces moved in several columns, as you see, totally not about concrete the sand in the middle, but taking over the strategic positions in there, and this business took 4 days. That's what I'm trying to show you. Now, it was an unusual strategy, but it worked, and that's all that matters. To be perfectly honest, once Nasser heard that the British and the French, after the first day, are talking about landing, he figured out there's some kind of collusion going on, and he told the Egyptian soldiers, pull out of the Sinai, because we're going to need you back home. So, and to some degree, to a certain degree, this happened in 67. But I just want you to know, even though we're all proud about Israel's military victories in 1956, 1967, since this is a history talk I'm giving, you want to be very honest about it, it wasn't really a fight, because on both occasions, in 56 and 67, for different reasons, the Egyptians chose not to make a big battle in the Sinai Desert, but to withdraw. You see? Nevertheless, as I said before, all that matters is what he wins. And so, the strategy worked, and as far as Israel is concerned, it was a conquest. Meanwhile, however, the international environment kicked in. Fighting commenced on Monday afternoon, October 29, 56. Consider that, Monday afternoon. By Tuesday, the UN had met to condemn Israel and to demand a withdrawal. Eisenhower had no idea that an actual invasion was happening. He thought it was a raid. And he wrote a statesman-like letter to Ben-Gurion, and basically what he said was, you know, and he could smell that because he had the CIA and the U-2 planes and everything telling him. And he wrote to Ben-Gurion, he said, listen, despite the temporary interests that Israel has in common with Britain and France, you ought not to forget that the strength of Israel and her future are bound up with USA. Okay? So those active in APAC and all know exactly what I'm talking about. So I was talking topless, as the expression goes. Next day, the Security Council meets. By then, it's clear that Israel is not raiding, but Israel is invading. As the Security Council votes to order Israel back, Britain and France vote against the resolution, which kills it, because they're one of the five permanent members who had the veto. So, just by voting it, so imagine the shock that hits the world, and Eisenhower and Dulles, when England and France, who had told us that we have Yodena Loshaf on the Ramadan, that we don't even know what's going on up here. And then, and England under Anthony Eden, which hates Israel, said like, oh, the Israeli army should not withdraw from the Sinai. All of a sudden it became clear what's happening. Shock. It dawns on Eisenhower that something sneaky is happening. And when Britain and France have announced that they're going to land troops in the canal zone, Ike smells a rat. Okay? And as I told you before, he wrote to the glory right now, he says, I don't know what you're thinking, but you do not want to alienate the United States of America. That's a big mistake on your part. Eisenhower is further enraged that the Israelis do this in the last week of a presidential election. A transparently cynical ploy that, let's face it, would be good fodder for an anti-Semite. Frankly, if this happened today, it would be in big trouble. One of the most important things to keep in mind is this is a good old 1950s. And I don't mean Avi and Harriet. I mean the good old 1950s when Israel had a monopoly on the American media. There wasn't such a thing as a Palestinian voice or even an Arab voice of any real proportion in the American media. There was, this is the good old days when there were only three channels, correct? It was ABC and CBS and NBC. And they were just starting with the news. And all the reporters, 99% of them, were just naturally, culturally pro-Israel. That's the way it went in those days. I don't have the time, but I could do it on some other case, maybe a little, if I was in a media class or something, where you just look at the, you get online, you look at the news reports that they used to show in the movie theaters, right? What's happening in the Middle East. And it's so pro-Israel, it's ridiculous. If they don't think Israel, if you imagine today, if Israel invaded the Sinai Desert, oh my goodness, right? At that time, Israeli forces moving to clean out Fede and Nest, and get rid of the terrorists, it's all pro-Israel. So Eisenhower had to operate within this environment, and therefore, the New York Times and the others didn't say, this is a shocking violation of American elections and all the rest of it. But it was, and Eisenhower's going to win. So it's not going to be something that they take lightly. That's the point I'm trying to say. Eisenhower and Dulles are further enraged because it is diverting attention from the Soviet crushing of the Hungarian Revolution. The Hungarian Revolution took place October 23 to November 10, 56, exactly during this time. Again, October 23rd to November 10th, it's exactly that time. And what happened to the Hungarian Revolution? There's Stalin's statue being smashed. Okay, the Hungarians had a huge uprising. They hate the Russians, who doesn't? And they want to kill them all and so forth. By the way, they also want to kill the Jews. So we should know it was a very anti-Semitic, anti-communist revolution. But besides that, and Eisenhower and Dulles were saying, "This is great. Now we get to expose the Soviets for what they really are." People around the world, especially in the emerging third world, will not believe all the propaganda that the Russians and the French are the little man and the small countries. You'll see the fit, and you'll see what it really is, and all the rest. And all of a sudden, people aren't paying attention to the crushing of the Hungarian Revolution. They're saying, Israel and France and Britain are attacking Egypt, which is a leading member of the third world. Look at the destruction. Let's go to the next one. Of the Russian tanks in Budapest. Imagine like sending tanks into Baltimore and start blowing things up. That's exactly what happened over there. These are captured in a secret film that were the Hungarian freedom fighters smuggled out to the West. And you see, oh my goodness, they're shooting all the in the parks and all the rest of it. And Eisenhower and Dulles going crazy. Said, nobody's watching this. They're watching Israel. You see? You're interfering with the plan. First of all, you're doing it without telling me. Second of all, you're doing it at the wrong time. You schlemazel. And so, it was really bad. The Suez invasion gives the Soviets a chance to act as champions of the third world, especially the Arab and the Muslim world. After all, if you're living in the Middle East, I'll give you an example, North Africa, Arabia, Iran. Who's the villain? Khrushchev crushing Hungary? Who ever heard of that? Or Israel crushing Egypt? Everybody heard of that. You see? So they're totally messing up the American propaganda line, which is a fact. On October 30th, if you follow the date, Israel announces right away that it accepts the Anglo-French proposal. That was part of the plan. And it will keep its forces away from the canal. Nasser says the opposite, and he calls for military resistance. The British and the French, this is part of the plan, land, armies, forces, they attack and defeat the Egyptians. Okay, so there was bitter fighting, course, the British and the French are much better soldiers. So the British fighting in the Suez Canal area in what they call Port Said, right? It's Malia, Port Said, all the cities that are located exactly on the Suez Canal area. And as you can imagine, here the British and the French paratroopers jumping out and landing. Do you understand what happened? You're Egyptian looking for it, say, next thing you know, you're being bombarded because they bombed the place first. And then, it's like D-Day. They land paratroopers and then from the sea, soldiers. It was a real invasion. Okay? Now, the British said, we're only doing this to separate the forces. But there was a transparent lie. And the world could see this, and it smells like a rat. That's the point I'm trying to get at. It's a messy affair. The British thought they'll come in. After all, the Arabs are like nothing, and they'll take over. These were elite British units. And, of course, 1, 2, 3, the British resistance will crumble, and then it will reverberate throughout Egypt, and Nasser will go into a panic, and he'll leave or get killed or something. It didn't happen like that. It got to be a messy affair, and it did not lead to the fall of Nasser, not at all. Let's take a look at this. Do you have the show? The you have the audio on that? All right. Well, the point of this is that the Egyptian people
Nasser refuses to go into hiding.
There you go.
He determines instead to rally his people after Friday prayers at Cairo's ancient Al-Azhar Mosque.
And then, indeed,
he's imitating Churchill. And sure, this is Nasser's finest hour, and it is. And recently, a year or two ago, in Egypt, they made a movie, which is a death movie, Nasser 56. He's like God. Because he held off, think about it. He held off the British and the French and the damned Israelis, and he kept Egypt together. He won in the end. Oh, it's a tremendous victory for him. They see it as a, you have to understand, he was Egyptian, he considers one of the high points in history, and he was a Churchill. When the country was invaded, he said, hold out to the end, and he won. So you have to understand that the whole world doesn't look at it from the Israeli point of view. Meanwhile, though, in Israel, they're elated. Especially Dayan and Ben-Gurion, but they won a big victory. They're worried all the time, is the Israeli army really worth anything and all the rest of it? And they conquered a huge territory. Take a look over here. This is the victory parade that Moshe Dayan has in the Sinai Desert. And you see the Israeli soldiers, each one's feeling 10 feet tall. And oh, look at Dayan, he's standing up again. So erect. Of course he's proud. The plan worked. And Israel demonstrated that even though they're not a fancy schmancy power, they're able to beat another army and conquer a huge territory, and they smash the Egyptians and so on and so forth. So they're not thinking about the international repercussions on that day. They're thinking about the fact that we won, which is totally understandable over here. And Ben-Gurion has gone crazy all the rest of it. He's basically drunk with victory. He gives a speech in the Knesset. The Sinai Desert is part of Israeli territory ever since the Bible. Everybody knows David HaMelech had this, and not from Israel. I mean, you know, he did it. Later on, they asked him, how can you say that I was drunk with victory? You know, I'm all in favor of Israeli expansion, but the Sinai Desert had never just, I mean, it is true we spent 40 years there, but not in that way. You understand? Ben-Gurion, I couldn't find it online, but it's the famous speech he gave in the Knesset. He says, and Sharm el Sheikh, the real name is, some Hebrew name here, and this is the real Hebrew name over here, and the whole business, he went off his head. Meanwhile, the Israelis, having taken the Sinai Desert, look what I'm doing. They went around and took the Gaza Strip from backwards, from Sinai direction, because he couldn't defend it that way. And when they come in, to put it bluntly, the Shin Bet has a list, and they round up all the Fedayeen and they shoot them. Okay? This is what they went in there for. Let's see this.
With the prisoners closed, full pressure was brought to bear on the Gaza Strip itself. This has always been a thorn in the nation's side. And the trap goes in, the Israel Defense Forces were in high spirits. The years of apprehension were over, and sweet indeed it was to tear down the fortress of Colonel Nasser, issued in vast numbers to fan the flames of Arab nationalism and hatred of Israel and the West. In God's Egyptian Governor General of Gaza came to discuss surrender terms with Adnan Benghoni. A year ago in Cairo, this man was a member of a spy tribunal which sentenced innocent Jews to death. Now humiliated, he tasted a bitter dregs of abject defeat. The surrender terms were discussed and set down on a hilltop overlooking an Israeli settlement which has suffered greatly from its proximity to Gaza. Committed to paper, the surrender was done, though few people are still naive enough to put much store by Egyptian promises undertaking or agreements.
Hey, it doesn't get better. This is a South African Zionist Federation movie taken at that time about showing to all the Hadassah meetings of the Sinai campaign. So you're going to get a totally balanced picture over here. objective, which is, but you want to know something? It shows you how Israel is feeling, how the Jews are feeling as well. It was a tremendous shot in the arm. And by the way, right in the middle of all this shooting, in the Port Said area where the British and French are, Israel sent a special boat, secret mission with Ari Eliyahu, who was a very well-known activist for working for Ben-Gurion, to take out the 200 Jews who live in Port Said and Ismailia. Okay? Because, first of all, they could get killed in the shooting, and second of all, if the British and French withdraw, what happens to them? Okay? The Jews will slit their throat, and I don't blame them. And the French, to their credit, they send like a battleship, and they put the 200, they take them to Israel. You think so? It's interesting, all the little details that happen in the middle of it. Meanwhile, however, Eisenhower, who's in the last week before the election, takes the decision, he says, I'm not going to let just be a regular politician and be pushed around and forced to say things that I don't believe. He says, I'm American, and Eisenhower is running what's going to be a triumphant second election anyway. But I got to tell you something. The level of political discourse is kind of interesting. Eisenhower had tremendous charisma, and it did, because it was a general in the Second World War. No, you can't take that away. But they sold him like he sold dope. Okay? And he knew this would win. Therefore, he's just waiting till November 6th to get the election out of the way, and then he can do what he really goes. But I thought, what are the great appeals to the intellect and the high discussion of public affairs that go on in American television in 1956 in order to back the re-election of America's most famous general? Let's take a look at this. Not anti-Semitic, I want to be very clear about this. Not at all. And he wasn't anti-Israel either, not at all. I don't say he would be in favor of the creation of Israel in the first place, but why would he? You understand? You know, that makes sense. But once Israel was there, remember, Abraham was the one who liberated the concentration camps. You know, and he wasn't a prejudiced kind of person or something like that, whatever his image is. Very balanced, a very wise person he is, especially in retrospect. That kind of people in that respect, but the historians, more they know about him, there's more respect. It's very interesting. Many of us grew up in the Kennedy-Johnson era in which they always used to dump on him, but that's actually inaccurate. And now that he was re-elected, all the rest of it, he takes a look and understands this well. As a superpower leader, Eisenhower sees things from a global perspective, which is perspective quite different from the narrower perspective of the British and the French. First of all, the invasion of Egypt has opened the Middle East to the Soviets. And he's right about that. After Suez campaign, from then on, Russia comes to a vote. So what was the point? You make everything impossible. It used to be that the Middle East was a bastion against Soviet expansion. Whatever they wanted to say, the Russians were kept out. And now, that crumbles. Khrushchev and Mao Zedong threatened to flood the Middle East. They said this during the invasion, with volunteers, you know what that means, as they had done in Korea. This gets them a lot of support in Syria, for example, which immediately moves into the Red Camp. Right up, starting with the Suez crisis, Syria will become pro-Russian, Egypt will then become pro-Russian, Iraq over there will become pro-Russian, and then all these states, many of them, throughout the Middle East will become more and more pro-Russian, and the original Eisenhower idea, or Truman idea, trying to hold them out of this territory, because they're Muslim, and they should be sympathetic with an atheist regime like the Soviets, and after all, the Soviets are just another form of traditional Russian imperialist expansion, and anyway, the Russians are oppressing millions, truthfully, millions of Muslims in Central Asia. All that will shed. All that will fall away. And instead, the Middle East that you and I became familiar with years ago will emerge, which the Russians are very well accepted over there, and they like them even to this minute, as you know. For example, who's the one holding up Assad? I don't have to tell you that, right? So, you know, the Russians are into invasions and all the rest of it. Then Khrushchev, during this crisis, threatened to nuke Britain and France. I mean, literally. He said, we're going to drop a bomb on London and Paris if you don't get it right away. To Israel, Khrushchev writes, you are gambling with your very existence. Now, these are nice, ambiguous terms, but Ben-Gurion understands what's being threatened over here. The British freak out. It's a parliamentary democracy, very sensitive to public opinion, and mass demonstrations spread all over England, especially in London, until King II, in which they go crazy, and they say, Anthony Eden, get out of here, you're getting us into World War III, we're going to destroy the country over some stupid business with the Suez Canal, you know, stop this right away. Let's take a look at this.
Eden had the awful realization that he totally misjudged the American aspect of the affair. Eden's plans are unraveling fast. He has not anticipated this level of hostility from the Americans, nor from his own people.
If you didn't hear what you said, then you're too stupid to get right.
Leader of the Labour Party.
Demonstrations in London as big as demonstrations in Eden.
So it was the opposite of public, you know, the result was the opposite of public support. In Britain, which is a parliamentary country, as you know, France, less so, but you had that problem over there also. Now, was Khrushchev bluffing? The answer is yes. We know now. But who knew that? Right? Who's going to say, I'm sure you're not going to drop anything about, oh, I guess I was wrong. I mean, you know, you don't want to be in that situation. Now, fascinatingly, we know today, Eisenhower secretly, because that's who he was, I thought he didn't like to do things in public, secretly sent a warning to the Russians, which is stay out or else. Now, let's see this.
The effect of the war was very real. At the time, later, well, we should have known they were bombing anyway, but at the time, it was a very serious matter. Eisenhower made it clear to the Soviets that if they became involved in Egypt, he would retaliate. And that he moved, hit them with everything in the bucket.
I do think a very, very
you know, the Russians respected Eisenhower as a general enough to say we're not going to play with that. But nobody knew this at the time, and Eisenhower was thinking, what are the Israelis giving those messages? What are the British and the French, what do they do all this for? In addition to being angry over the new opportunities offered the Soviets, Eisenhower was angry over the oil question. Now, this is a very complicated matter, but it's not that complicated. These are the oil pipelines, right, which provide the oil to get to Europe. If they're cut or sabotaged, guess what? It's a disaster. And Eisenhower said, how does a company like England or France, who are so totally dependent on Middle Eastern oil, play around with something? What were they thinking of? Their economy is going to be destroyed overnight. And that means America will have to help them? Now, listen, in 1956, you want to cry what I'm about to show you in a minute. Well, in 1956, in the good old days, America did not import oil. At that time, we still had enough of our own. We did our own oil. You know that? It was coming. We were using it up. And then later on, we have to start importing it. But not in 56. So America is okay. But your business. Now, America at this time, oh my goodness, how much was it? Who remembers? How much was it for the gallon? What's that? Well, that's 23 cents, it seems like. Yeah. You know, the Gemara says, when Rebbe saw this, he cried. You see, but it was what it was. So this country was pretty safe as far as the oil is concerned, but not so. Take a look at this. Some people, especially the young people, won't believe what they're going to see over here. You know, this is a gas station in 1956, out of there, 23 cents, and one second. And what else did they do for you? They washed the car. Remember this? Okay? They do the tires. They look under the hood. They had all for free, right? It's all part of the price. Okay? Okay, we gave you this. Now, I told you, any other comment? No, but seriously, I know what you're all coming from. This is the America of Eisenhower. That's the reason I'm showing you this. Right? Plus, I want everybody to cry a little bit. But he says, this is the American guy that lived before the Arabs turned the spigot off. But at this time, we didn't need the Arabs. Now, Europe, on the other hand, gets its oil from the Middle East. And if the Middle Eastern countries, when they see the invasion by Britain and France, they want to... You can turn it off now. when they see this, they want to cut off the oil to Britain and France. And Eisenhower says, someone says, take it easy, don't do that. I'll get them out. Don't cut off the oil. Cool down. We'll make it all work. You know, so on and so forth. If it happened in 1956 that the Arabs cut off the oil, the U.S. will have to supply the oil to Europe. And the gas, God forbid, can go to 40 cents. Eisenhower will be impeached. You know what I'm saying? He is not in favor of that scenario. You get it, the dullest of them, it could go to 40 cents. It would be a disaster. So, without being funny about it, it was a real problem. And as the leader of the free world, by the way, Eisenhower is exquisitely sensitive to international economic stability. It's actually very interesting. Eisenhower, the president, was famous for not spending money on the defense. There are many generals and admirals that quit under Eisenhower because they used to be told, you're a general, you spend the money on the army. And he said, as a general, I know how much is wasted, and I know what it hurts the economy. Here, says, take a look at this. He's unique among the presidents.
By the time Eisenhower is president, there is a huge new flow of cash into the defense industries.
He was the first to acknowledge that a permanent military establishment would be required during this period, but that unless we could find some kind of breakthrough, that in fact it would end up creating a terrible cost.
The cost of one modern day bomber in the A modern brick school in more than 30 cities. It is two electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 population. It is two fine, fully equipped hospitals.
We pay for a single fighter plane with about $500,000 wages a week.
We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people.
This is not a way of life at all. And that includes them. Under the cloud of threatening war, is humanity hanging from across the line?
Okay,
Jeff.
Is president
and
strong
principles. You get the impression. I don't do the whole thing. Eisenhower was very sensitive to the balance. He was afraid of what would happen, which did happen, of course, which was what broke now. We're how many trillions in the hole, and we're not getting out of it. Any way I can see, or anybody else can. And in other words, you can have defense to bankrupt yourself. That happened to Russia 20 years ago. And it was terribly afraid. I mean, you have to give him credit. He foresaw this long before it happened, and his last speech, I'm sure you all know, is when he warned against the acquisition of unwarranted influence by the military-industrial complex because it was bankrupted. You see? And so, I'm saying this in praise of Eisenhower. Here he is in the Suez crisis, the timing campaign, and he says this can interrupt the international economy, the flow of oil, the price of energy, ruin the country, and, you know, and this is very bad for America, or has the potentiality to be very bad for America. So it's not a joke, you know. Israel has just done something unilaterally. England and France have just done something without thinking about it. I got to look at the whole picture over here, and I'm responsible because of the largest country for the whole free world, which was not a lie. I'm saying, this is not anti-Semitic. This is not anti-Israel. It's a real consideration. And so all I can say is we have enough hindsight today that to understand, because you have to be objective or try to, at least I think so, that Eisenhower and Dulles worked very hard and successfully to keep the Arabs from doing what they eventually did 17 years later after the Yom Kippur War. Okay, you remember that? When all there was the gas shortages, as you see over here, and all the, and the cars and everything lined up. That could easily have happened in 1956. And he worked always behind the scenes, that's his style, you know, and always, you know, secretly. And it did not happen. So you have to give credit where credit is due, because he was looking from the American point of view. And by the way, you know, in retrospect, I would not want to have think what would have been the reaction anti-Israel had the gas gone, all joking aside, had the gas gone to 40 cents in the 1950s when we started the big gas selling cars and everybody would end up blaming on the Jews. That would not have been good, my friend. Now, meanwhile, as far as English and the French go, Anthony Eden and Guy Mollet, they say to Eisenhower, you're all wrong. If we don't act like wimps, the Arabs will know their place and they won't dare to embargo us. They're thinking like in the old pre-World War II days, we'll never know if they were right. Because it's true that the Arabs are scared of a big violence. Who can tell? But with Russia as a factor in now, this is just not realistic. Eisenhower and Dulles say to France and England, you're nuts. That is literally, you guys are crazy. Meanwhile, as far as little Israel is concerned, they hold on to their conquest, but they look like the aggressor, and Dulles is determined Israel will not get away with it. Now comes all the big United Nations votes, and now comes the finest hour of Aviva, or one of them, because he goes to the United Nations as Israel's ambassador, and he's able to switch to as long as he could, to turn the issue into one in which Israel's a victim. You understand? And he makes the argument to be made, and that is, I'll just read you very briefly over here, I couldn't find it online, surrounded, he says, understand where we're coming from, surrounded by hostile armies on all its land frontiers, subjected to savage and relentless hostility, exposed to penetration raids and assault by day and night, suffering constant toll of life among its citizenry, bombarded by threats of neighboring governments to accomplish its extinction by armed force, overshadowed by a new menace of irresponsible rearmament and battles, blockaded, besieged, Israel alone among the nations faces a battle for security anew with every approaching nightfall and every rising dawn. In recent days, the government of Israel has to face a tormenting question. Do its obligations under the UN Charter require it to resign itself to uninterrupted activity to the south and north and east of armed units practicing open warfare against it and working from their bases in the Sinai Peninsula and elsewhere for the invasion of our homes, our land, and our very lives? Or on the other hand, are we acting legitimately within our inherent right of self-defense when, having found no other remedy for 2 years, we cross the frontier against those who have no scruples in crossing the frontier against us? And he goes on to say, there is aggression, there is belligerency in the Middle East, but we for 8 years have been its victims and not its authors. And again, I won't read the whole speech, it'll take too long. But, you know, he was Israel's best speaker, I mean, we all know that. And he's able to make an impression in the world. John Walter Dulles was, went over to Mastowards just as a professional, speaking to him, and said, he didn't have any notes or something like that. And Avivah showed him, he had three lines that he worked out of. And Dulles said, holy cow, except he didn't say cow. Now he pulled it off. But that's not going to turn everything around, but at least it looked like Israel does not have some aggressive. Put a little bit of context on this. We didn't just decide one day to invade the Sinai Peninsula for fun. There's a background to all of this. Huh? I mean, how would you like it if you were England or America or someone like this, if you were raided by terrorists all the time? You and I know what the United States has done ever since 9/11. And with the full support of the American people. And so he said, we've been under this for all the time. Eden and Malay, the prime ministers of Britain and France, had figured they could stymie the United Nations through their veto in the Security Council, which is true. However, this opens the door for communists, for Red Volunteers, which was Eisenhower's worst nightmare. So to prevent this, Dulles looked over the rules of the United Nations very closely. He was a famous lawyer, and he found that there was the United Nations General Assembly Resolution Number 377 from November 1950, called the Atchison Plan. And that means that during the Korean War, Stalin, using his veto, had stymied everything in the United Nations, and then Atchison, who was the Secretary of State on Truman, figured a way to use the General Assembly to do the things that the Security Council is not able to do. And Dulles said, let's use that now. And this allows the General Assembly to initiate measures over there. The General Assembly, so in other words, they immediately get the whole General Assembly together after all the nations of the world. They vote to order a ceasefire, and you can't veto there, and the sending of a United Nations army to the Suez Canal area. Eisenhower then threatens Britain and France, behind the scenes as always, that if they do not submit, America will cause a financial panic in their country. In other words, he has a masterful use of soft power. Basically, the United States is probably even in this situation today. Consider those of you who are investors. All America has to say is, you know, if any kind of trouble happens in this country, the United States will not really back their currency. If you had money invested there, what are you immediately going to do? Right? It'll be a crash. Everybody pull the money out. You see? And in the 50s, the gold situation is still under the old Bretton Woods agreements. The United States controlled the gold supply. So if the American bank, the central bank, says, we're not, even if they say it like I'm saying right now, we're not sure we'll supply the necessary gold for all of it. Anybody who's got any money in Britain, gone. And what does that do? The British economy collapses. And it's like the 1929 crash, instantly. And Eisenhower didn't have to do a thing. He didn't send any soldiers. He didn't make any speeches. He just said, I'm not sure if we'll be totally able to, and he said it privately. He didn't say publicly. Because if he said publicly, that would cause the crash. And he didn't want to do the crash, you understand? He just wanted to have the effect of being able to force England and France out. So he's saying, behind the scenes, I'm not sure I'll be able to do what's absolutely necessary to help you guys this time and the other. On the other hand, if everybody leaves, I'm sure that we'll be able to find out. That's all it took. Now, it didn't happen overnight, but it happened. Anthony Eden is up the creek. And so his health collapses at that time, and he just crashes, and he goes to Bermuda for a month, right, to recover. GI stuff, but he had a bad illnesses and so forth. And the result is that he flees the country. John Foster Dulles that week came down with colon cancer. I can't hear that. I'm sure a lot of people curse him, you know. And he gets emergency surgery right there in this whole China campaign business, and it gains him another 2.5 years of life. And Anthony Eden's absence, which takes place over 4 weeks, 8 weeks, Britain obfuscates. But nevertheless, over the course of November and December, Eisenhower very politely insists that they withdraw. Otherwise, there'll be no help for your economy and it'll crash. And the British eventually do. Britain and France had promised Israel they wouldn't do so. They would not leave Israel alone. But hey, things change. And this is Europe. Eden, Anthony, is defiant. He is unwilling to admit that he's wrong, ever. His policy was half-baked. Britain was simply an honest broker. Look at this speech he gives. He says, we are totally right and honest in this whole matter. He's got a real politician's face.
What is likely to lead to a widespread bailout in the Middle East and the judgment of the government? What is likely to endanger widespread British and international interest? If what? Well, it's possible to go on arguing who was the aggressor. Was it Israel because she trusts the country? Or was it Egypt for what she's done before? But that's not a real issue in my mind. If you'll see afar, the first question is, how is that? But how to put it out? The hard and inescapable fact. But the here with the situation, likely to inflame the whole Middle East with all that this would mean. That is the government's view.
Now, of course, this is a bold lie. He makes it sound like, you know, we're faced with this situation. We have to intervene for the best, for the help of world peace. Collusion with Israel? Chas v'shalom. Ben Gurion is so angry at this, because remember, even, I don't know who's right, maybe Israel's right, maybe he's right. Ben Gurion is very tempted to stick it to him. He just publishes them in the New York Times. Well, what did he care? Right? But he didn't do it. Ben Gurion says, if I gave my word to keep it secret, I'm going to keep it secret. And he never did reveal it. And that paper from Sefer that Israel still has it in Ben Gurion's house, and they won't open it. And what's it called? They don't care. All the rest of it. Anthony was so grateful that he wasn't totally exposed as a liar, because he stood in Parliament and said, we know nothing about this, that he does 180 and becomes the lover of Israel. I kid you not. Right? And in his older years, there was when he was an old man, he's the chairman of the Pro-Israel Society of England, of the Conservative Friends of Israel. You should read, if you want to have fun, read, you can get a library, the memoirs of Viscount Eden, and, you know, especially the last years. And, oh my goodness, when it comes to Sinai, all the Israel number heroes, he says, Ariel Sharon did this, and most of them, yeah, you think he's a member of the ZOA or something like that, right? Because he was always terrible, he was very grateful that Israel never exposed him, so to speak. And so when the word got out by drips and drabs over the coming years, during his lifetime, I think he died in 1970, you know, it never quite did. They then publicly embarrassed him. So it's really funny, this guy who took Arabic as his major in Oxford, who was an Orientalist, who was a lover of Arab culture and a hater of Jewish, for the last 15 years of his life, became the Shabbos guy. It's unbelievable. As far as the French are concerned, Guy Mollet, he said to Ben-Gurion, he said, listen, France is stuck. I'm ashamed to say France has to leave you in the lurch. France feels ashamed, but we're stuck. What can we do to atone? So Shimon Peres delegate, what about A-bomb? And that's how it happened. You know, Mollet said, okay, we'll give this fable consideration. And this began a process where, as I told you last time, and Mirza Hashem will deal with this next year, in the aftermath of the Suez crisis, in the middle of 1957, France actually does go whole hog and give Israel the full cooperation to help them develop their nuclear research. They never used the word A-bomb, of course. Help them their nuclear peaceful research. But it's a compensation package because France felt guilty that they left Israel in the lurch in 57. Right? It's amazing, okay? And Tim in Paris was always the right guy at the right time, as I told you last time. He's always in Paris. This would help. Okay? And so, having pushed out Britain and France, it took them 2 months, November and December, but having pushed up 56, Eisenhower now turns to Ben-Gurion. New? Ben-Gurion says, we will leave if Israel makes peace with us. Real peace. Then we're willing to withdraw, and so on and so forth. If Egypt makes it obvious. We'll withdraw if Egypt makes peace with us, the real peace. Eisenhower says, no, you'll leave now. Nasser says, peace with Israel? Why should I make peace with Israel? They invented us. What did they deserve to have to do peace? The opposite. This has confirmed their essentially aggressive nature and how evil they are. Under pressure from Eisenhower, Israel withdraws partially and slowly over the course of November, December, but holds on to a line running from El Arish, Sharm El Sheikh, which of course includes the Gaza Strip. You understand, no, they from the Israel held on to where I'm pointing here, right? Not half, you know, the last a quarter of it. So they let the Egyptians take over all of this, the middle, and the part adjacent to Israel, let's put it that way, especially the part that has Sharm El Sheikh and Devon, which controls the entry to the Gulf of Aqaba, the Gulf of Eilat, that's what they still held on to. Nasser doesn't have to do anything. He said, Eisenhower was doing all my work for me, which was true. Now, Ben-Gurion then digs in his heels, and he says, we will not withdraw from the rest unless we get security guarantees. We want no more Fedayeen raids, no more blockade of Iraq, etc. Dr. Hammarskjöld, who's the Secretary General of the United Nations, is so angry, somebody wants to benefit from aggression, becomes a matter of principle to him, and says, there should be no reward from aggression. Israel must withdraw without anything. After it's all over, then we'll consider the situation. The King of Saudi Arabia, King Saud, he says, if America doesn't get the Israelis back to the old frontier, we'll close down your bases over here, and we'll make an oil crisis. Okay, this is the wrong guy. This is the father. But it doesn't matter. You get confused with Saud and Ibn Saud and all that, but there aren't such people. Anyway, the fact is that the U.S. needed big Dahran. You know, remember, you've heard about that in the paper. The U.S. has gigantic air bases, which they need for security to convert to Russia. in the Arabian Desert, besides the oil itself. And the king of Arabia said like this, he says, why should we help America if you're not going to get Israel out of it? Eisenhower was telling us, Israel is such a pain. Right? Where do you guys come from? Ben-Gurion said, without guarantees, we will not move. Eisenhower said, well, let's do sanctions and force you to move. Same thing with England. I don't have to lift a finger. America depends on the American aid. You can get along without it. You know that. The OLA says, UJA. Don't actually even do that. Just make it that the UJA is not tax deductible. You cut down by two-thirds at least, or more, the amount of money that the Americans do send to Israel. America doesn't have to do a thing. You see? And the Dulles was not wrong about that. Meanwhile, Avi Ben is on the American news all the time, swaying public opinion. He was Israel's secret weapon. He goes on CBS and NBC, you know, all the shows over and over again. And Avi Ben, of course, is so eloquent. He said, we're ready to go. We really don't want to go back to Fede Inves. We want the blockade. Why should we? Why does Dr. Hammarskjöld insist on this? Now, Israel has a position too. Why is it necessary just to satisfy the ideas that the aggressor should not gain from anything, that we should literally go back to a situation in which, what, you put the terrorist bases back in here and then start negotiating again? That doesn't make any sense. Eisenhower is adamant, and he says, we have to do this, and I don't want to blockade Israel. I mean, I don't want to sanction Israel the rest of it, but if they won't leave, then if it's necessary to do so, they'll do so. He can't do it. This is LBJ's finest hour. Okay? Johnson was the Senate Majority Leader. The Democrats had one vote majority. In those early years, it was one vote for Republican, then next time it was one vote for the Democrats. So like 48 to 47, something like that. And Lyndon Johnson, I'm sure, I'm looking around, I think everybody here is old enough to remember what I'm talking about. He knew how to get the votes. And he tells Eisenhower, he says, you do whatever you want. I'm telling you right now, this is a personal thing with me, there is no way under any circumstances that I will allow you to make any sanctions against Israel. That's it. And then I got the votes to do it. And Eisenhower tries to reason him, and he says, I'll get the House as well as the Senate on my side. Dulles said, let's try the Republicans. The Republican leader in the Senate, the minority leader, Senator William Nolan of California, very interesting guy. He was the best friend of Joe McCarthy. He's an extreme right-wing Republican, but you can't tell. See, people nod their heads. You don't know everything. American politics is more interesting than that. This guy, who was a super McCarthyite and anti-communist, all the rest of it, was a leading senator on civil rights, and he's also a leading senator for Israel. So you don't know. You see what I'm saying? Facile assignment of people to certain categories reminds me of like the worst aspects of Shachanim, you know? It's in there. And so Nolan tells Dulles, he says, I'm against this Senator. Probably you don't have any votes for this in the Senate. Okay? And so stymied, what does Eisenhower do? He turns to Abihail Silver. She's amazing. Okay? Now, Abihail Silver, of course, had been Mr. Zionism in America. Not only that, Abihail Silver was a big mouth in the Republican Party, even though he always voted Democrat. Okay? Again, you can't tell by facile classifications. Okay? By the way, my best story, somebody here, maybe she's here tonight, 2 years ago, I spoke about Abihail Silver. Somebody here came to me afterwards and said, my father was a film Jew in Cleveland, and he was a big fan of Abihail Silver, always went to hear his Sabbath sermons. And even though it was Orthodox Jews, he went in there, and I said, what do you do about Shabbos on the rest of it? Oh, no problem. The service is always on Sunday. It was real reform. He didn't have services on Shabbos. The real reform. Anyway, having said that, though, I can tell you right now that when Eisenhower ran in 52, Truman, Shadarko, so I guess, any Jews that vote for that anti-Semite can go straight to hell. That's what Truman speaks. And who said Eisenhower was anti-Semite? So Abihail Silver made a whole speech around the American community and said, I guess you can vote for Eisenhower, you can vote for whoever you want. But Eisenhower is not an anti-Semite. I know him. Okay? And he's a regular American and all the rest. Excuse me. Oops. Jake? I don't know. I guess it is. I can't afford to play with that. Okay. You may regard that as a commercial break. But Abigail Silver gave the speech, the prayer at Eisenhower's inaugural. You understand what I'm saying, right? And if you look what the New York Times says over there, they moved into tears, Eisenhower. Because, he, you know, this book, he was in Dachau, you understand? I mean, it meant something to him. If a Jew said like this, he says, Eisenhower's an honest man. You and I think it's all politics. People care about their integrity. Some of the guys that I did also. And to be validated by Silver was very important. The reason I mention this is that in crisis situations, it's very interesting. Eisenhower felt very uncomfortable talking to Ben-Gurion. He felt like a brick wall. But Abigail Silver, he said he'll get the message to Ben-Gurion. Even though he didn't realize that Ben-Gurion didn't like Abigail Silver because of Zionist Jewish politics, but what else is new? Anyhow, Silver talks to Israel's influential friends in the Republican Party and in the Eisenhower administration. He speaks to Tom Dewey, who had been the Democratic candidate, the Republican candidate for president in the 40s, and to Walter Regal Smith, who just resigned as Undersecretary of State. He had been Eisenhower's chief of staff during the Second World War. These are pro-Israel, big macho Republicans, and he's saying like this. He says, explain to us that Israel's not in the wrong with this, and if you put in sanctions, it'll wreck the country, and the country will go down the drain. Take it easy over here. Still, it's not simple. Eisenhower will not yield on what he regards as a matter of principle, a matter of international law. You see, to Eisenhower, a breakdown of international law will recreate 1931. They say 1931. That was only 25 years before, when the Japanese took over Manchuria, which was against the law, and the League of Nations didn't do anything about it. And you know what happened? That showed everybody they can get away with it. Next thing, Hitler and Mussolini came along. Next thing you know, the whole world was engulfed in World War II. So if Israel is able to hold on to the territory simply because they conquered it, then who's to stop another country from doing the same thing tomorrow and the day after? I tell you again, Eisenhower told me, I have to look at it from a global perspective. I can't do these little narrow-minded things. If only the world had put his foot down. Henry Stimson had been the Secretary of State in 1931. He said, that time, if we stop Japan now, we'll stop World War II coming, and the whole world will laugh at him. It didn't work. And he was right. So the American tradition in the State Department of American Diplomacy, which is not a bad tradition, is one that says we have to stand for the maintenance of international law, and that's why Bush went in when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait and things like this, because the alternative is much worse. It's very far from a perfect world. I understand all the hypocrisy and all the rest of it, but consider the alternative, and Eisenhower's generation had lived through the alternative. And anyway, Ben-Gurion said like this. Ben-Gurion says to Eisenhower, what about Russia? You're not kicking them out of Hungary. What about international law over there? Right? You're not doing anything about the tanks in Budapest. And Eisenhower said, what? Are you comparing yourself to the communists? Are you comparing yourself to the atheists? That's what he says to Ben-Gurion. Okay? And Eisenhower, stymied by LBJ, and by also he was stymied by the sympathetic media and the sympathetic elites. I mean, here's the big rally that takes place right during the Sinai crisis, but Eisenhower is threatening Israel. Here's Eleanor Roosevelt next to Moshe Dayan, and if you see Ben behind with John F. Kennedy, I mean, they hold the ground. Remember in Manhattan? Anybody remember that? So, what, the big...
Zion.
Yeah, right, Zion. So, what do you call it? The Israel is having huge rallies in which the leading members of the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant establishment are lining up in favor of Israel. I tell you again, it was a golden era. it's the Avin Harris for the Jews. The people saw from Israel's angle, and Avin Eben is giving a speech over there, and oh my goodness, you know, that's the way the American public was doing. Ed Murrow was the number one journalist at that time. He was America's number one. They remembered him from the Blitz. Here's Ed Murrow going to visit Ben-Gurion to get his take in the thing. What do you think is the right way for you to go? What do you think? Ben-Gurion's going to give you an even-handed answer? That's where the American public was. So Eisenhower takes his case to the American people in a remarkable and blunt television speech. Okay? You can see the words over there. I won't take the time to read it all, but it's quite powerful. And he puts it laser on one, and he says, listen, I don't want to hurt Israel, but on the other hand, you can't let them get away with it. And as he said, we're not going to apply to Israel the same standards that you would do to the atheist despots of Russia. Okay? This is supposed to be a democratic country. This is supposed to be a country that regards itself as a member of the free world. So you can't just unilaterally go and break the law as the word taken with somebody else's territory and expect the United States of America to go along with it. It's not going to happen. And therefore, I'm pushing Israel. I'm asking the American people to back me over here. on this because it's a matter of principle. Now you have to understand, Eisenhower had tremendous charisma and tremendous authority. I want to tell you, I didn't have the whole speech over there. Only he could get away with this. You know, Eisenhower was the only guy in the 20th century who was elected president of the United States who was bald. Okay? There, many have written on that. And that means, of course, Stevenson was too, but nevertheless, it's something. He gives a speech and he says like this. He says, "My fellow Americans, I have a cold tonight, so I may have to blow my nose and cough a few times. I beg your pardon beforehand." Can you imagine, in this meeting age, somebody with it? He doesn't give a darn. You understand? He says, "I have nothing to prove. I won World War II. You elected me and re-elected me. I can say it the way I see it. It's remarkable." And he says like this, "Look, you've got to stand behind me, because otherwise if Israel gets away with this, the whole thing breaks down." That's what it is. And so the result is that Avi Ibn says to Ben-Gurion, sends him a telegram that you're pushing ice too far. You make a big mistake. Okay? Don't do this. You know, if he blows up, you're in big trouble. He's a nice guy, but you're going too far. Ben-Gurion says to Avi Ibn and Golda Meir, then okay, then go get the best deal you can get. And here you have Golda Meir, who is a foreign minister, right? The minister of foreign affairs. She goes to Washington over there, and Golda Meir and Avi Ibn try to nail down Dulles, and they say, you know, let's take a look at the next thing over here. Now that's a lie. That's one of the things you can't believe in the news. Dulles was a Wall Street lawyer, very slippery character if he wanted to be, and his client right now is the United States of America. And what Ben-Gurion and Golda Meir and Avi Ibn wanted Dulles to do was to sort of sign on the dotted line to guarantee certain basic Israeli demands. Number one, no more terrorists. Number two, the end of the Gaza Strip. Number two, no blockade of Eilat. If you get Egypt to agree with this, we will withdraw. Not just that the Dulles, we're not withdrawing, no way. Right? Like I say, why should I? Dulles says to Hammarskjöld, "How about if the United Nations occupies the Gaza Strip?" So you're thinking like a lawyer. I got this client over here and this client over here. Can we come up with something in the middle? How about if the Egyptian army doesn't take over the Gaza Strip again? But how about if Israel gets out anyway and the UN sends a peacekeeping force over there, an army over there to do that? Hammarskjöld says, "What does that mean? Will Egypt approve?" Nasser said, "Well, we will not formally approve, but we'll informally declare anything to get the Jews out of there." You see? And Dulles said to Dr. Hammarskjöld, "Will the United Nations take over Sharm el-Sheikh?" So the Egyptians won't be there, but they'll be at the gateway to the entrance of the Gulf of Aqaba. And once again, Hammarskjöld says to Nasser, "Do you agree?" "I know, I won't say I agree, but you know, like, in other words, yes." Okay? And you know, if you don't cause me to say anything, so I'll agree. This is a real good lawyer deal. You understand? He's trying to make everybody happy. Golda Meir says, "Nasser's not signing anything. He's not committing himself to anything. This is a temporary trick. After a while, he will reoccupy everything, and we will be back to square one." Which, by the way, did happen in 1960, you know, it happened 10 years later. But right now, Dulles says to Golda Meir, "Look, the perfect is the enemy of the good." Right? Golda says, "Well, what will the U.S. do if Nasser reoccupies?" Dulles says, "We can't guarantee that. But we can guarantee, I can't guarantee what Nasser will do. But I can guarantee what the U.S. will do." Now let me rephrase that. We can't guarantee what the U.S. will do, but we can assure you, as a lawyer, what the U.S. will do. Which is, we will regard the Gulf of Aqaba as international waters which may not be blockaded. Golda says, "Does that mean, you don't understand, no, she's trying to have it out. Does that mean that if Nasser blockades in the future, you'll break the blockade, run ships through there?" Dulles says, "We cannot guarantee that we'll go to war. That's up to Congress." Then Avi Ben says, "Well, again, here's a good idea. Let's make a defense treaty with the United States, like NATO, which commits the United States to break the blockade." And Dulles says, "No." Dulles says, "Look, after all, you know what I'm saying? Those, all these sessions go back and forth and forth and back." And Dulles says, "Look, it boils down to this. You've got to pull out. There's no two ways about it. If you pull out now, you will have the sympathy of America and the Western world. If you do not, relations will sour big time. Ike is not foolish. Consider, American sympathy is really your most important asset. I repeat, American sympathy, not formal alliance. You may not like that, but that is really the best Israel can hope for. Such are the facts of your life. So, as your friend, your attorney as it were, take this deal. Pull out, and America will be your friend, though we will never be your formal ally. Abi Ben says to Ben-Gurion, this is the best deal possible, take it. Ben-Gurion says to Eshkol, who is the finance minister, how long can we hold out if America cuts off the money? Eshkol says, a few weeks, maybe. Ben-Gurion says, okay, in that case, get the best deal you can, and then we'll pull out. Dulles says, we promise that we don't formally commit to the UN occupying Sinai and Gaza, and the UN running the Gaza Strip, and to sending ships through, we will send ships through to a lot, and agreeing that it's an international waterway. And that's the most we're prepared to do. In March 1967, Israel pulled out reluctantly. It was dropping everything. Eisenhower said, I'm happy that you decided to listen. You will not regret it. Ben-Gurion says, oh, we won't regret it? Does that mean you'll sell us weapons? You'll make a NATO treaty with us? No. Nasser, meanwhile, says, I never agreed to any of these dollars in Abraham deals. In spite of what I just said, Nasser does not kick the UN out of Sinai and the Gaza Strip, though he reserves the right to do so. He's not interested in starting a war either again, although publicly he is, of course. On the other hand, he does take control of the Gaza Strip. So Ben-Gurion has been promised that the UN will run the Gaza Strip, not Egypt. Nasser sends in, but it's Egyptian police, not the Egyptian army. So the Egyptian police from 57 to 67 are running the Gaza Strip, which is a very unusual type of situation. Nevertheless, although he said he wouldn't, Nasser did respect the agreement until May of 67, as we know. This resulted in Israeli gains. No Syrian bases in Gaza. Consider that. Okay? Thus, a relatively quiet, I emphasize relatively quiet, Israeli-Egyptian border for the next 10 years. Unlike 52 to 56, which I've described to you in detail, from 57 to 67, it's one or two a year, which is pretty good. That, you know, that's as good as it gets. You understand? It's one or two or three a year, where it used to be one or two or three a day or a week. So the border got a lot quieter on, as far as that's concerned. They also demilitarized Sinai Peninsula, because part of the understanding was Egyptians wouldn't set up large military things in the Sinai Desert. That's left to the United Nations. And so, although Nasser didn't realize it, probably Ben-Gurion either, Israel gained something invaluable, which was a tripwire. This is what they used in 67. Consider, here is the Egyptian army, where I'm pointing over here, behind the Suez Canal. Here's Israel, of course. It's impossible for Egypt to make a surprise attack, but first, the Egyptian army has to go in and take over the Sinai Peninsula, which is a logistic business, takes a couple weeks. So automatically, any time Egypt wants to do anything against Israel, it's going to be with a long lead time for Israel to find out about it. That's the sign that that Egypt is getting serious about war. That is what happened in May of 57. Right? Then he went in at 67. And went in and didn't go out, and of course, you know, it led to the Six-Day War. I can tell you that there was a mistake in 59, I'll do this next year, the famous mishap, where the Egyptian army went into the Sinai Desert in 59, and all of Israel went to a panic, and an officer, Mayor Zareya, and the high command ordered a full Israeli mobilization, and Nasser said, what happened? It was a screw-up in communications, and immediately send a message to Ben-Gurion through, I forget which intermediary, it's like, if this was a mistake, we're pulling out of here. And that's what happened, and both sides pulled out. So I'm trying to tell you, although nobody planned it, it turned out to be something, a valuable defense tool, I would say even for both sides, but certainly for Israel. Kept both far away from each other, even though you understand that Egypt still owned the Sinai Peninsula, and Egypt still formally controlled the Gaza Strip, but not really. And so Israel could look at this as real gain, and also an unblockaded Eilat. Now again, Nasser said the blockade is still on, but his army, on purpose, is not in Sharm el-Sheikh, and nobody's enforcing it, and Israel's going in and out. That's what happened. And also, don't forget the extra little bonus over there, A-bomb. Israel got a bunch of goodies, in other words, out of the Sinai campaign, from the Israeli point of view. And finally, I would say, Israel got tremendous military prestige. Okay? Now Israel always sells itself in the Ben-Gurion time as a leading world in peaceful matters, scientific research, and the social advance, and all which is true. I'm not the matter is, Israel got real prestige after 56, because everybody, like, yes, ooh, they won a war, you know, they're tough. Israel's amazing. What's really remarkable is, Israel got tremendous prestige in the third world, which should really not be in favor of Israel for practicing naked aggression against Egypt. Here is some of the main leaders.
Israel, too, has gained from the war. It has, at the time being, removed the Egyptian threat from its borders and shown the world it was a part of the event.
As usual, every world is every country, every other country of this group that simply easy to destroy Israel, and Israel is called enough to defend itself.
And in 1956, there are thought that Israel is a phenomenon that we disappear, it's a temporary phenomenon. Only in the 56th war, they realized that this is that we are able to stay. And the pressure from the Americans and the United Nations, the Israelis withdrew from Sinai the following year. The Israel victory had given its army and its people newfound confidence for the future.
I think eventually we gain 10 years of quiet, of the ability to develop our industry, our economy, and our army to such a level that when the war came again, we not just remake on the previous expansion from flooding the China with forces and being put in the entire army, we could defeat.
So you get the idea. The interesting things that I was saying for even in the third world, look over here. This Golda Meir with the leaders of Kenya, Jomo Kenyatta and Tom Mboya. These are famous people from yesteryear. And seminal figures in the African independence movement. And they're very interested in Israel. They say publicly, because of Israel's social development and the kibbutzim and all that sort of thing. But behind the closed doors, that how do you win the Friday campaign? Where do you get your tanks? Where do you get planes? Because that's where countries are. And by the way, as a result of this, Golda Meir is able to launch all these programs in Kenya, part of which is that they do all these scholarships to help African students go around the world. One of them is a guy named Barack Obama Sr., okay, who ends up, that's him, eventually comes to America and marries this girl over here, who is the children of President of the United States. So, you know, let's put it this way. If you like conspiracy theories, and I know in the Middle East they love conspiracy theories, you have to understand, the entire election of Barack Obama is dated back from the Sinai campaign, where as a result, Israel got his entry into the African independence movement and used that to start an education fund in order to get Barack Obama Sr. And if you laugh at it, I get it, but you know and I know, I can guarantee you that some website somewhere somebody's pushing this kind of stuff and millions of people are believing it. It's clear today, it is to them, that Barack Obama Jr., the President of the United States, a Zionist plant from long ago, and look how clever the Israelis are. Okay? On the other hand, Nasser emerged with glory. Okay, let's take a look at this. You have that?
Preaching bankruptcy, the Nassim Prime Minister, and publicly criticized by ISIS, the British government had no choice. The United Nations moved in, and the British and French moved out. Once again, the militia triumphantly marched through the streets of Port Said, and the crowds were in Egypt here. For Egypt, this was massive.
The man who had
moment they were laughing that the Egyptians in 67 said, we won 10 years ago, we're going to win again. From their point of view, right, that they came out on top of the end, they won the war. Now, I understand how much, aggrandizement goes into all that, you're lying to yourself, but you could also understand the way they thought, okay? And they were determined to read it that way. So Nasser emerged with glory. It is precisely because both sides gained something that this patchwork agreement of dullness and Iban held for a decade. Okay. It could not have held if both sides were inside. Dulles, at the end of the day, was a clever lawyer, wasn't he? You know, in order to make an agreement, what's the main thing you have to have an agreement? Both sides got to have something to walk away with. You see? And they did. It's the only thing is, in the long run, the structure was too wobbly. In 67, but to tell you the truth, you know, he just made a mistake, Nasser, in May of 67. He did not have to go this route, and he made a series of errors. If he would have been a little more cautious and so forth, it wouldn't have happened. And the basic idea of the structure was not a bad one, even from Israel's point of view. Look, consider comparing it to today. At that time, the Gaza Strip was still in the Gaza Strip, and it's full of Arabs that hate Israel, all the rest of it. They weren't shooting at Israel. You didn't have Hamas. You didn't have the Fatah. You didn't have any of that kind of stuff. You had a civil administration by Egypt. The United Nations controlled the frontier areas. They wouldn't allow anybody to shoot missiles into Israel. I mean, it's as good as it gets. Okay? It doesn't get better than that. So, even though people make fun of John Foster Dulles, and he says an anti-Semite and all the rest of it, it's not really true. He put together a deal that kind of worked, but the structure was too wobbly. Israel expects and hopes that as a result of their concessions, they'll get better treatment from the U.S. during the second Eisenhower administration. Would they? So, which way will it go? Okay? That is something, of course, we'll have to explore next year. Here's Eisenhower meeting with the Muslim Brotherhood in the second administration, which that time was considered a very positive anti-communist organization. History is very interesting in its permutations. So, as I say, I'll leave the future for the future. Good night, sir.